Welcome to the Heartbreak Kids Podcast, where we explore what connects us all in our yoga practice and in our lives. This is where I talk to people about their stories, who they are, what they've been through, and where they're going. And in this podcast, that's what we explore. I believe deep down inside, we're all connected, which explains why we bring ourselves to the top of our mat every day. Welcome to the Heartbreak Kids.
So welcome to the next edition of the Heartbreak Kids. I'm here with Anna Forrest and Jose Calarco, and they are special guests. They've been yoga forces for a really long time, and I couldn't really pass up the opportunity to get them on the Heartbreak Show, to really get them to talk a little bit about their story and really what yoga means to them. So I really appreciate you guys being on the show today.
Thank you for having us, Tyler.
We love getting people via an interviewer.
Yeah, and we also like to meet people in person occasionally. So we're counting the days the lockdown is over.
Yeah, exactly. Well, one day hopefully our paths cross. But I couldn't miss this opportunity because, you know, I remember a long time ago when I started my yoga journey, I had a book, and the book was actually, I believe, from Yoga Journal. And it was a bunch of amazing black and white photos. And I went through this book and I just went over like really all of these people doing amazing poses. And I remember coming across, your pictures. And I think you were doing Simhasana or something like that with your tongue sticking out. And I was like, that is crazy awesome.
Yep. I was in Lotus too. Lotus Cobra doing Lion.
Yeah, it was beautiful. Just a beautiful book. It was gigantic too. It was
like I was in that for I think 18 different pictures in that book.
Wow. Yeah, it's really beautiful. So I'm really grateful that you guys are on the show today. So let's talk a little bit about your backstory. You know, I feel like you know everyone knows both of you as yoga teachers. But like, what are you like as a human being? Like, where did you come from? How were you like when you were in high school, college, in that area of your life?
Wow, that's a really, really good question. Well, when Anna and I came together, it was in 2014. So we've now been on the road for 6-7 years together. Anna was already an established international yoga teacher when I met her. And my field, I came from a background in veganism, shamanism, Aboriginal culture, musician, dancing, all these ancient healing techniques from the Aboriginal culture. I also was director of that dance company, Descendants Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Dance Company. So my background came from all this old cultural and healing stuff, and I integrated that with what Anna already had to create a one-off magical experience of what we do together. You want to know how we were like at college? I was a bad boy.
Yeah, me too.
And I'm sure you were too, Taylor. We'll leave that to another day.
Today's a good day, Jose. We can talk about it. It's all right.
I was a rock musician, so I went through all the things that rock musicians usually go through until I had my spiritual transformation. And then from that point, that's when I got into the veganism, shamanism, Aboriginal culture, and ancient healing techniques. And I took that rock star persona into the yoga world. Together we come up with something pretty different to the majority of other yoga teachers. And we have a system where we move the body, still the mind, express the emotions, and nurture the spirit. So
awesome.
Yeah, when we got together, we thought, you know, yoga classes can sometimes be cheesy, like we spoke before. When I first got into the yoga scene, there was a lot of cheesy teachers, and I thought, oh my God, you know. But
it happens a lot, actually. Like, people get inauthentic to a certain degree.
Yeah, so Anna and I are realists, so we wanted to give a real experience, and we also wanted to use some of this shamanistic Aboriginal stuff that we learn in ceremony, where we create this deep spiritual feeling before the class starts, and we maintain that right to the end. And so Anna and I are all about authentic teachings.
Awesome. Yeah. How about you, Anna? Like, where did you come from? Where are you from?
Well, born in New York, part of the family moved out to California when I was about 3 and a half. I was born crippled. I was a very sick kid. Came from a history of abuse. I started drinking very young, so I was a preteen's alcoholic. Smoked a lot of cigarettes and pot and anything I could get a hold of. I was poor. And I started hanging out very young, about 6 and a half or 7, at a rent stable or rent horse stable. And did anything there that I could in order to get to ride. So I would clean stalls, I would groom the horses, I would do anything so that they would let me ride horses, because I was drawn there so powerfully. And one of the great things about starting at a rent stable was I learned how to take care of horses, but I also learned in a very funny way how to love. Because that was my first love, was the horses. It wasn't people, and it wasn't family, because my family were not lovable.
I totally feel that. Yeah. I've been there, done that for sure.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, not all family is love. So
no.
Horses is like one of the great things for them is that when I did get to ride, they strengthened up my legs, which were not strong. You know, I had a hard time standing. I was walking and as a child, but not well. And so I got very strong with my legs with the horse world. And I learned how to care for another being. I learned how to interpret signals, because horses don't talk in English, but they have lots of ways of talking. And so it trained me to pick up these other kinds of signals that humans also put out. So years of riding horses and working in the animal world and with other animals and being in the wilderness and, you know, loving the wild ones. And at a certain point, it became really clear to me, because I was always working with the animals that had been wrecked by humans, that if I really wanted to make a difference in the world, I needed to work with the humans and get them to become more sane so that the animals were not always being tortured or killed by the humans. Because I was working with show horses or dogs or cats, sometimes a snake, birds, and they were all somewhat too vastly insane, and they were driven insane by their insane humans. And it's like, okay, This is I can work with animals for the rest of my life, but I'm not going to handle what the root problem is. And I had been doing yoga at this point from 1973. I started yoga. And
wow.
That's a while ago, yeah. And I came out of the horse world, sold my horse, sold my stuff, and took the money that I had from that and paid for a yoga teacher training course that was residential. So in the process of that, I stopped drinking, stopped smoking, and became a vegetarian. It was a tough month because I did everything all at once and was in this yoga environment that was really quite helpful, but it was also up in the mountains in Guadalajara, Mexico, at a retreat center that had a hot river running through it that had been used for healing by the local Indians there for eons. And so I was in that hot water just trying to wash the filth out of my spirit and out of my cell tissue. So I kept studying yoga, and the more I studied with other people, the less interested I was, because I just felt like it wasn't hitting the mark for me. And I went into my studies of medicine, Native American medicine, not allopathic medicine. And that hit the heart post for me. That hit what I needed to get to. I needed to reclaim my spirit because it had been abandoned a long time ago. And so as I learned and did more and more ceremonies in the Native American ways, I started having to puzzle out, how do I bring this into yoga? And so I started learning how to take things off the mountain and bring in vision questing or working with intent or doing the yoga in a way that we're very specifically focused on healing. Like we'd have a class on healing the back, and you choose which section of your back is, and I coach people how to do that. Or, you know, I started weaving in the medicine work because that is what helped me save my life, is the two together. And it was a life and death situation for me for a while because I was pretty suicidal as a kid. And so yoga and then yoga and medicine together gave me a reason to fight and win over my own monsters and find something worth living for and learn how to love, because I didn't know how, and learn how to make a difference in the world.
As yoga students come to us with so many problems, and we figure that the yoga teacher these days has to do so much more. You know, people are having financial problems, relationship problems. They come to us with suicide. It's crazy what's going on. And in order to, like we get them for two and a half hours at a workshop, these complex people with so many problems. So we had to make sure that 2.5 hours we have with them, we have a system of hope. We also have music and ceremony in every class. So we had to create something where we can give the student a sense of hope at the end of the class.
Yeah, that's great. You know, it's I listen to both of you, and, you know, it seems like that there's like some major similarities, you know, from rock and roll and sort of this undertone of what happens with, you know, rock and roll people and sort of the craziness that goes along with that. But then also, Anna, your background of, you know, being crippled and like struggling, you know, with family and stuff, like there seems like there's something very similar between the two of your stories. But I'm really wondering, like, on a deeper level, like, how does that translate into your yoga teaching? You know, like, specifically, like, how do you take those previous experiences and help other people get through the times like you guys had?
Well, for me, like, in working with the animals, I learned how to listen very deeply so I can pick up signals on a human being, like what's going on at a deeper level other than just fixing the pose so it looks pretty. You know, that's not really the point. It's like how to use the pose as a way of vision questioning and as good medicine. But also when people come with their terrible stories or their deep pains or whatever, it's like I have a place of being able to relate to them, but also a knowing that you can walk through this hell and get out. There's a way out of this. And so I bring that truth. We teach from what's true for us. We don't teach, you know, so much what's passed down through the books. It's like, it must be true for us or we will not teach it.
And we also use music very intelligently. I don't mean like, you know, OMs and all that sort of chanting. We bring a certain type, we bring a variety of musics in. I'm a keyboard player and I bring in Dreamtime soundscapes. We also bring in ancient songs and ancient music. And this connects at a really deep level because music can do stuff that words cannot. So the physical practice is so important to move the body. Like we said, we look at the person as in four parts. We have to move the body and get the heat and get the sweat going. In the process, we still the mind with the injection of music. There is some poetry readings at parts of the class as well. And we ensure that the spirit is nurtured by the end of the class. When you combine all the medicines together, then the person has this amazing feeling at the end of the class, but we can't do it for them. You know, they have to be their own light, you know. Following the light of another person can lead to darkness if you're always always chasing that person. But we give them the tools to go away and start their own thing. But the daily physical yoga practice is imperative. But they also need to do much more than that. And connecting, showing them how to connect with nature, beginning a program of insight, which can be music, dance, writing, that's also another important part. At the end of the day, we got 22 hours off the mat, 2 hours on the mat. So the 22 hours that are off the mat are essential. Like, well, what are you going to do with that? You know? So we give suggestions there.
Also, I mentioned this briefly before, but the way that we sequence the pranayama and the asana classes is really intelligently put together so that the kinesiology of the poses can work their best medicine. And the way that we coach people is to go on vision quest within the sacred arena of the pose for their healing, for learning something new about oneself, for moving out the blockages or the numbness or the sickness or the scars. You know, it's like the poses are one of the physical places that people can work on the great mystery of themselves.
Sure.
And
go ahead. Sorry.
Well, I just wanted to tell a short story, which was very funny, because like when Jose and I first met, we were, you know, sharing parts of each other that were important, you know, like, hey, this is who you're talking to. And I told him one of my big secrets, which was something I was just working on, which was I was starting to do this thing of putting my hands on people, because I'm a hands-on healer also, and sing my medicine song into the area that felt disrupted in them. Like if they had back pain or disc injury or uterus disorders or whatever, you know, I would sing to the area that was sick, but it was a big secret. Or I would do Brahmari, which is a buzzing. And so I was just working on this, and I didn't quite understand how it was working, but I could feel that it was like starting to rearrange the structure inside, like rearranging the atomic paradigm. And so I began to kind of shyly explain this to Jose, and he kind of looked at me and he said, my people have been singing into the bones for 40,000 years. Oh man, we got to talk.
Yeah, there's a lot there, I'm sure. There's a lot there.
Yeah, 40,000 years, 50,000 years ago, there was no doctors or hospitals, and nomadic tribes and my people from Australia, the Aboriginal people, relied on the shaman and medicine person to sing his heavenly songs into the bones. They would also use herbs. They would also go on long walks. This was the medicine back then, and it still works to this very day.
Yeah, it's just forgotten a little bit.
A lot of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it also, you know, from my studies over in India, you know, this is sort of similar to some of the Hindu traditions and with the chanting and all of that, like, you know, but directly into the bones, that's entirely different thing, for sure.
Yeah, well, India developed something called Nara Yoga. Do you know what that is? Have you heard of that? Nara means...
I've not.
Yeah, nada means sound. So they were working on rhythms and sound and sitar combined with the tablas in particular to create certain environments of healing. But they were not as direct and literally to the bone as the Aboriginal people were. But India was starting to they've been working on the Nadi Yoga thing for a while.
Yeah.
So they were also tapping into that wisdom, but in a different way.
Yeah.
It was also coming from Greece with Pythagoras, when Pythagoras first mapped out music and mathematics. He found that there was healing qualities when there was a combination of letters. And it's really funny how Pythagoras discovered music. Music in the Western world was discovered when he was sitting and he heard four anvils and hammers were crashing. And then he heard sometimes when they crashed together, they were discordant. And other times there was some harmony. So he had to find the 12 notes of music and the intervals, spacing, and relationships. And from there, that was one of the first music theories of healing. And of course, Aristotle and Socrates took that music healing further. This was from the West, but I believe in ancient India, this music healing was already happening. And of course, before then, my people in Australia, which is the world's oldest living culture still today, were doing musical healing as far back as 40, 50,000 years ago by playing and singing the didgeridoo into the bones. So it's nothing new, music and healing.
But to use the music in a healing way is part of the medicine that we need to bring back into the culture. The indigenous people, like in the U.S., had also had their ways of doing that in ceremony. And like when Jose and I met, I had four Native American songs that I used, but that was all that I could carry, plus my own medicine song. And that was all I could do. You know, I'm not a musician. I'm not a strong singer. And yet I felt the importance of these songs. Also, they were very simple songs, so I could teach them to my students so they could learn how to get a voice instead of being so shut down with their voice. And then when Jose came and he could write songs for the students and have and has written different Native songs and he has the Aboriginal songs, it became a whole beautiful cornucopia of soundscape healing.
Wow, that's amazing.
He writes the poems that he reads and he writes the keyboard music and we have wonderful, wonderful music for people.
The way to describe a class that Anna and I do is it's like watching a two and a half hour movie, or depending how long the workshop is. You know, we always make sure that we have this beautiful spiritual musical beginning, and then an intriguing midpoint, and then a happy ending like everyone wants in a good movie. So it's very, very scripted out how we are going to spend this 2.5 hour with them and how we're going to get to this happy ending, you know. But moving the body is essential. Like Anna and I come across a lot of people like anti-physical yoga. We've taught in India. We've taught all over the world, Anna and I. And we always come across this belief that the physical part of yoga is irrelevant. You know, they always go, oh, no, yes, I do yoga. I sit down for 2 hours each day meditating. That's my yoga. I don't move the body. So Anna and I see this as critical of moving the body, heating up the body, getting a little bit of sweat. Exercise is very important in mental health. So Anna and I disagree with the people that continually put down the physical aspect of yoga, saying that the mental aspect is much more important and yoga off the mat is important. We agree with that, but the body needs movement every single day.
It also feels really respectful of this great gift of life. Just it's like, oh, you know, the yoga poses, they're less spiritual. They don't matter. It's like, yes, actually they do. And this is also goes into one of the songs that Jose wrote. As I said to him, one of the problems that my students run into at different points in their evolution is they get to this ignorant, arrogant place where they consider themselves more spiritual than whoever they're talking to. And it's very irritating to be around someone running that racket on you. And so I just said, Jose, I call it the I'm more spiritual than you syndrome. Would you please write a song about it? And he did. And it's really funny.
Yeah. You know, it's funny because I care about the postures as well. I'm an Ashtanga, or I'm an authorized Ashtanga teacher. I've been teaching Mysore style and traveling to Mysore, India for a long time. The poses matter. So I'm totally in agreement. And I also believe that, you know, we take the practice into our daily life, and we have to live that too, you know, in those 22 hours. And so I totally get what you're saying. A meditation is great. Pranayama is great. But you got to get the exercise. You got to get the focus with the breath, with movement, and all of that kind of stuff. Because I feel like it's almost a way of honoring, like what you said, but it's a way to really connect with your body as well. So yeah. I'm totally in agreement with that.
I want to go back
just a little bit, though. Anna, you said a couple things that I feel like the listeners need to get some clarity on. First one is, like, you said, like, sort of a vision quest inside the pose. What are you actually talking about there?
In the using the pose and using the whole paradigm of what we're teaching, the 2.5 hours or the 27 days or whatever people are going on the journey with us in, to quest for what they need. So, for example, if the intent of the class is working with back pain, you explore the poses and how to move in the poses and how to breathe in the poses in a way that alleviates your pain. You learn to use the poses, in this case, for back pain, as a healer. Just doing them isn't necessarily good enough, because if you're doing the pose in a way that is continuing to irritate your injury, you're just making it worse. So it's like learning with a good teacher, with good hands-on assists, learning how to use the poses to heal. Also, as you go into your fear or your pain or the unknown places or stripping the numbness away, you end up face to face with what you're afraid of. And anytime you work your way through your pain and fear, you evolve. And taking responsibility for your own evolution, to me, is like the sexiest thing ever.
So what I was just about to say there, Taylor, was in shamanic terms, what Anna is talking about, we have a similar thing in the shaman's term, and we call it the second attention, doing your yoga from a place called the second attention. The first attention is very trivial, and it belongs mostly to the neurotic, self-centered ego. You know, what am I doing? What's next? Blah, blah, blah. But underneath the chatter, there comes another attention, and this is the fertile ground that shamans work from. So whenever we do a healing, a prayer, or whatever, or we put our intentions into the universe, we must always come to the second attention. The first, nothing can happen in the first attention. It's too busy, too neurotic, too dysfunctional. So the vision quest begins when we come underneath the mental noise and coming into that really vibrant attention. And when teacher and students hit that together, it's a magic moment.
Wow. That's awesome. How do you hold, you know, like I hear, you know, back pain, and I hear that, you know, the students sometimes are broken and things like that. How do you hold space for those people? You know, like, how do you not take that stuff on?
Why would I take it on? You know,
great,
it's
question.
Like, because someone has pain, it's like, hey, here's some tools. Let me teach you how to use them. But it's very clear in my heart, and we make it clear to the student that this is your healing process. This is your responsibility. We will give you good information. We will tell you how to use these tools. We'll work with you over and over. But the process, the evolution, is theirs to do. Their pain is not my pain.
Yeah.
And when I worked as a trauma and abuse therapist, it was part of my own process to let myself feel people's pain or fear or whatever it was, so that I could empath and feel what's going on and be able to be a better guide that way. And years ago, it took me a while to learn how to not take it on. It's not mine. Though some people's problems and pain are similar to mine, but in that case, it's like I need to be very clear. Like, I'm the teacher here. I can lead the way through here. I don't have to get stuck in someone's swamp.
Yeah, that seems like you got a lot of healthy boundaries there.
Yeah, boundaries. You know, it's a different thing, because when I feel when people hear like, oh, you have to keep boundaries, it's like putting up all these walls. It's like, tear down your fucking walls. Tear them down and learn how to feel in this world and respond appropriately.
Yeah. That's great insight.
You're right, Taylor. During a teacher training, which is 27 days, it's very hard not to be affected, because all their stuff comes up. So all their fears, their thoughts of suicide, all their problems, some can know how to manage it and some do not know how to manage it, and some need our help more than others, but it's hard not to be affected. We need a good hot shower every night after a training to literally wash them off us.
Yeah, and that's actually one of the things that we do is consciously using water to clear. But it's like our training is designed to pull up that toxic stuff so our people have a chance to get rid of it, to discharge it. And it comes out of the cells. It comes out like snot and diarrhea and, you know, crying and people projecting that we're their worst demon or their best love. And it's just like, whew, we learn to hold steady in it, but not put up walls. Walls are not the answer.
Yeah. So people are coming to yoga teacher trainings, not to learn the postures, but they're really coming there to, the only chance for healing is to bring up their subliminal data and get it out there. And, they just can't hold it inside any longer. So it's really funny. They're coming there to become yoga teachers, but really we are teaching them to become spiritual teachers and process all the emotions and unfelt data, which has been building up over an entire lifetime.
Yeah, and so like in our longest course we have right now, which is the 27-day Foundation Teacher Training course, people get a tremendous amount of work done. They dump a lot of stuff and they make, this is so important, they make a good beginning on how to change the pathway of their life. It's a beginning, even though every single day has breakthroughs and breakdowns and this and that, you know, it's, and people who don't understand organic process, they think, well, I should be done after 27 days. It's like, you're not.
You just started. Sorry.
You know, and people forget in this day of instant gratification that certain things take some time. Like if you plant a seed, you can't keep digging up the seed to see how it's growing. You need to leave it in the dirt so it can grow and sprout, you know, or if you are planting a baby, the baby has to sit in utero for 9 months, 9 months, not 27 days. And then it comes out pretty helpless. And it's like, understand the rate of organic process and start applying that gracefulness to oneself. In other words, if you've been doing really lousy behavior, like being an alcoholic or doing eating poorly or whatever, it takes a while to get the new changes incorporated. To get the new, for example, if you change your diet from being a corpse eating junk fooder and you decide to go to being vegetarian, it takes a while for your body to start to crave these new good foods. And it still craves the old garbage for a while, but the cravings are not necessary to obey. It's just like, it's just a craving, like a drug craving. You re-educate yourself. And so It's like this choosing to educate oneself is an amazing choice.
It seems like you guys are actually kind of teaching student development courses.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's like, yeah, it's like, I mean, and it's sort of similar to some of the things that I do. Like, I don't do any teacher trainings, but, you know, I have basically like mentorship programs or apprenticeship programs and things like that, where it's like, no, we're going to initiate you into the process of your healing, learning like what the system of yoga is, and, you know, give you the background, give you all that stuff. But this is just the beginning. This is like this is the start. This is the starting line, you know? And so that's really good, because I do feel like in the instant gratification place that everyone goes to, it's like they get done with the 27 or 30 days or however long it is. And they're literally like, okay, where do I go? Where do I begin? Who do I need to save here? You know, it's like, yeah. And that's a scary place to be for yoga teachers, or especially new ones.
Yeah, yeah. But there's also a flip side to that instant gratification, which is a little more insidious and downright evil. It's like thinking that, you know, oh, it has to happen this fast. You know, I'm supposed to be enlightened, or I'm supposed to be a whatever it is, you know, a great yoga teacher. It takes a while to build into greatness. But that expectation of it's supposed to happen now, underneath that comes guilt and shame, because they don't know what to do. And so then there's this self-degradation that comes in there and starts a downward spiral, and a disbelief and untrusting of one's own process. And so that needs to be dug up and exposed as a lying belief system in order to be able to move forward and grow in a real way.
Yeah. I'm totally with that. You know, another question that I had sort of in the back of my head, you know, because like I see so many similarities to, you know, how I teach and, you know, compared to how you teach. And I'm wondering, like, for both of you, like what does yoga even mean to you today? You know, so I mean, like, there's obviously a depth of knowledge that you guys have. And so I'm wondering, like, what is the simple definition, and like, what's the bigger vision for you with yoga?
With yoga? For me, yoga is moving through fear. Ultimately, all our lives, we need to move to the other side of fear, as they say, because what we want is always on the other side. But some people prefer to be in lockdown and never explore fear. And Anna and I have been people that take chances in our lives, and we've always used fear as an ally, because when you start moving in the midst of fear, all these opportunities come, and it ain't such a bad thing once you are entangled with it. And so fear actually becomes an ally, and you use that energy of fear to manifest what you want.
You know, people are trying to always run away from what scares them, or their pain, or their suffering. And the fact is learning how to journey through all your pain and your fear and your suffering can help breed heroes. It's like, this is the hero's journey.
Fear and pain has bred many heroes. That's one of my quotes, actually.
I like that quote.
I like that too.
To Anna, when I wrote that quote.
Yes.
Yeah. And so how else does it, you know, how else does your yoga like relate, you know, in the world, like, Anna? How else do you present the yoga path to people?
It's a way of life. It's a way of life. And the yoga, traditionally yoga, the way we teach it also, though the guidelines are different, is there's guidelines in every aspect of life, and to choose on behalf of your spirit, not on behalf of your neurosis. So to recognize when you're at those choice points every day, whether you want to choose to fight with whoever you're with because you're just so damn irritable about being in lockdown, or you can go underneath it and make a wiser choice. In that moment, are you choosing to create more garbage, more psychic smog, or are you choosing to make the situation between two people or in the home a better place to be? You know, what is your warrior's choice? When you choose your food, make a warrior's choice for what is going to build your luminosity, not what's going to make you fat, stupid, and constipated, for example.
Are you allowed to swear, Taylor? Are we allowed to swear
already been
on
down,
this
baby.
Program?
Yeah, we've already passed that point. But
oh,
yes,
okay, okay. Well, one of the teachings that we always bring is to disobey the motherfucker in the mind. You know, people say, what is the motherfucker in the mind? The motherfucker in the mind is the person that is the bully in the mind and generally pushes you to the brink. And
pushes you into your addictions.
Exactly. Sure. The one that says, yeah, let's have another drink. Let's have another line of cocaine. Let's stay. Let's become codependent, miserable people. And for some reason, each mind has one of these things we call motherfuckers. And every now and again, we need, well, most of the time, I like to shut the motherfucker down totally because that's the addict. So we use that terminology. It's quite funny. Some people don't get it or, but.
I'm from Ohio. Because like sailors, it's funny because like in my workshops, I'll have to apologize for cussing before I even do it.
Yeah.
I'm a yoga person, but I'm also going to be swearing because I get pretty passionate about things.
Yeah.
I love that, Taylor. I love it.
Yeah. We like to, I call them power mantras.
People go,
that's awesome.
That's not very spiritual, Jose. You know, swearing. Well, I'm an ex-rock and roller, guys. Sorry.
Yeah, I don't apologize for the way that I speak.
Yeah, I probably shouldn't do that either.
I mean, the sacred ones are not offended by the way that I speak or teach, and that's who I answer to. Not to somebody else, not to some human's rules about like, oh, well, in yoga, you shouldn't speak that way. It's like, you can make those rules for yourself, but don't try to put them on me.
It's funny because, you know, when I was first kind of, you know, I obviously saw you in that book that I mentioned earlier, but one of my first exposures to you was a lady, her name is Alex, and she had done one of your trainings in Colorado, I think. I'm not 100% sure where it was, but I think it was Colorado. And she was like, this lady is amazing. She'll look right at you. She'll cuss at you. She'll tell you the straight answer. She's hard-nosed. And I was like, who is this lady? And she's like, Anna Forrest. I was like, wow. It's like, you know, because it felt so revolutionary sort of at the time. And this is maybe 10 years ago, something like that. And I'll never forget it. I was like, all right, she's like, this lady's who she's supposed to be. And that's freaking awesome.
It is. Like Anna was a breath of fresh air when I first come across her. I actually met Anna in an elevator of all places in Sydney. People go, how did you and Anna Forrest get together? Well, we met in an elevator and the rest is history.
Wow.
We met in an elevator going up to Body Mind Life yoga studio where I was presenting a ceremony from her. But what I liked about Anna was being in the world of yoga. Like we spoke before, there was a lot of cheesy OMs and teachings and this and that. And I just, you know, spiritual diabetes was going on. And then I saw Anna and I thought, oh, yeah, that's, you know, that's, there's no spiritual diabetes there. It's straight to the point, cut the bullshit. And that's the sort of person I thought, well, you know what? That's the sort of person I want to work with in yoga and share my lifetime of experiences with the Aboriginal people and the shamanism and magic that I had learned from my 30 years with Aboriginal people.
Wow. Well, how do people get in touch with you? And, you know, tell us like what you're doing after this stay at home order. You know, like, where are you guys going? What are you scheduled to do?
Okay, well, firstly, you can get us at forestyoga.com. And forest is spelt with a double R. So www.forestyoga.com. You can go to our website. Anna and I tour 30, 35 cities, 20 countries every single year. We have been doing this 6 years back to back. We just finished a 35 city tour before this lockdown began. So after this, we are supposed to be going to Austin and Chicago in June if the lockdown is over. And then in August, we have a teacher training in Berlin if the lockdown allows. And then we have gigs all over Europe and Russia. Russia's a new market that Anna and I have been exploring. Russia and China are actually two markets that Anna and I are currently exploring.
And we just did a online 3-class course called Under One Sky. And so that's available on our website, and it's bringing together the music, the prayer, the asanas, the focused intent, you know, the ceremonial yoga. And some of it's shot out in the wilderness, so you get that beautiful energy from the trees. And yeah, you could check that out too. That is available on our website. And
awesome.
We have been writing and working on another trilogy that will be filmed pretty soon.
Yeah, yeah. So we're working on a groundbreaking trilogy, which some of it is shot in the yoga room, some of it is outdoors, going into the four directions, the history of ceremony, music healing. It'll be absolutely a groundbreaker. And we've been working on that for the last month, writing scripts. So that's the next trilogy coming soon. And that's called May the Rainbow Always Touch Your Shoulder, which is a Cherokee, part of a Cherokee prayer.
Wow.
The asana sequences are delicious because we've been doing each of them every day. And it's just like every time we're done, it's like, wow, that feels really good. I really like that class. So we've been test driving it all month, the sequences.
Yeah, that's great. Well, I'm really happy you both were on the show, and I appreciate your insights. And, you know, I got a lot out of it. And so I appreciate you being on and taking the time out of your day to, you know, talk to the Heartbreak Kids audience. I think a lot of us will get a lot out of what you guys said.
Oh, by the way, Taylor, did you get the Heartbreak Kid from that wrestler? That famous wrestler, Shawn Michaels?
No, I didn't. I got it from Kanye West.
I just wondered where you got that title, because there's a wrestler called Shawn Michaels, known as the Heartbreak Kid. Look him up.
I know who you're talking about. I know that for sure. But you know, I got it from the Heartbreak, Welcome to Heartbreak, and it's on an album of Kanye West. And I'm a Kanye West fan. And I think he's kind of a musical genius in some senses. But someone asked a long time ago, well, what, I feel like your students are the Heartbreak Kids. And I was like, why do you say that? And they were like, well, because all of them have come to you because they've been broken, or they've had heartbreak, or they've had addictions, or they're struggling with bulimia, or whatever it was that they were struggling with. And someone said it one day, and I was like, oh yeah. And then I remembered the song. It's called Welcome to Heartbreak, and it's literally one of my favorite songs. And then the Heartbreak Kids podcast was started. And so that's how it came to be.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being on the show. I appreciate you guys, you know, sharing your insights, and I loved having you guys on.
Thanks, Taylor. We like being here with you.
Thank you, Taylor.
Hey guys, thanks for tuning in. If you want more information about Ashtanga Yoga, visit ashtangayogacolumbus.com. You can also check out my website, which is taylorhuntyoga.com. See you guys next time.